Cheer up, honey, I hope you can.
You gonna have Mike Ruppert on the phone then?
There is something wrong with me. My mind is filled with silvery stars.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and our guest is Mike Ruppert, who's been on before. He's one of the early people to write about peak oil. He had this newsletter, the From the Wilderness, which has sort of been reborn as an interactive blog, which has got some really neat stuff. And he also wrote the book Crossing the Rubicon, and now his latest book is A Presidential Energy Policy, with some specific things that this country can do to get through the peak oil crisis. So, Mike, welcome to KBOO.
Per, it is so great to be back with you and all my friends back up in Portland.
Well, it's good to hear you again. I think a lot of our listeners are, you know, they're pretty familiar with peak oil. So we don't have to go into all the basics, but what are the sort of the where are we now as far as peak oil goes? It seems to me that our biggest oil suppliers are rather problematic. Think of Saudi Arabia, Mexico, and Canada. Whoops. Hello? Have we lost him? Hope not. We seem to have lost contact momentarily, so I will tell you that Mike Ruppert has written this book, A Presidential Energy Policy, and he kind of describes the sort of the latest with peak oil, where we are right now, and he goes into a whole lot of detail on Iraq and Saudi Arabia, the food, growing food, and alternative energies, and sort of gives us the latest update on all those areas, and then writes a lot about the money system. And without money, nothing happens. And the way money is going now, all sorts of bad things are happening. And then finally, okay, Mike, you there? Hello?
Okay, I'm going to reboot the system.
Oops, we reboot. Okay. And then finally, he finishes up with a 25-point policy to help this country get over, get through its peak oil crisis. And they are, some of them, it seems to me, are, you know, there are things that people can do right here in their local areas. Some of them are being talked about or are being done to some degree, but others are not. So I hope we can get into those, because it's not just a gloom and doom book. It tells us really specific things that we can do to alleviate this problem. One thing I started to ask Mike about before we had our difficulty was that our suppliers are kind of problematic. One big supplier, could be number one, is Mexico. And Mexico's big oil field, the Cantarell field, is severely Okay, Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we are here too. Finally, I've been talking a bit about your book, and I started to ask you kind of where we are with peak oil right now. And I was saying that it seems to me our big suppliers are problematic. And I mentioned Mexico and Saudi Arabia and I guess Canada.
Well, it's look, it was spelled out pretty starkly about 4 or 5 months ago by the International Energy Agency, which said that, look, we have a global 9.1% decline rate.
Mm-hmm.
That means if we were consuming 86 million barrels a day in 2008, we will have 9% roughly less than that. Some of that may be offset by a couple of small new projects. But, you know, take off 7 million barrels a day from what the world can consume. That decline rate is accelerating. It cannot possibly be offset by any new production because it takes 5 to 7 years to bring a field online, and global oil discoveries peaked back in 1964. We're now using about 6 barrels for every barrel we find, and that gap is increasing.
Well, like you quote Matt Simmons as saying, we need 3 Saudi Arabias just to offset this decline.
That's correct, and they aren't going to be here.
If there were any more, we'd have found them by now.
That's correct.
Well, one thing you talk about, maybe you should go into this a little more, is that global, you know, the reason that oil prices are down now is because of the economic situation. Basically, global demand has been destroyed.
That's correct. And, you know, it was destroyed, you know, with a capital D, which means that the economic collapse, of course, which, as you know, Pear, and many of my longtime followers up there in Portland know, I was predicting in very precise, specific and accurate detail for years. It came about just as I said, but the collapse was so severe that demand wasn't just curtailed, it was destroyed. And now it's questionable. I mean, the point I make in the book very clearly is that if the moment there is any kind of a recovery or anything that looks like a recovery, the energy to support it will not be there because there's a 96% correlation between GDP growth and greenhouse gas emission. You have to burn energy to have a recovery. So, you know, that's not going to happen. It's going to be a brick wall. But, you know, I'm even questioning now at this moment because the economic implosion is so severe. We're chasing a $700 trillion derivatives bubble. And that's why all the money that's being printed is going to banks and not to people. So we have a real mess on our hands.
Well, do you think that this demand destruction was it done for that purpose, or is it?
Well, I don't think there's any question but that mm-hmm. demand destruction was initiated, if you will, intentionally. I have taken a very strong and well-documented position over the years that the Bush administration was deliberately and intentionally looting the U.S. economy. I don't think it's any coincidence that the big collapse crash happened right as they rode out of town, having transferred the wealth to their base, so to speak. But, you know, this is out of control. In other words, they set something in motion, arrogantly probably, assuming that they could control it, and they can't.
Well, what as far as peak oil goes, then the economic meltdown has brought down oil prices. It's sort of amazing that the prices went from almost $150 a barrel all the way down to less than 50 in just, weeks. And that is really kind of amazing when you think about it.
Well, yeah, it is. And but you know, that's a double-edged bad sword, because with oil prices having collapsed to the levels that they're at now, investment in alternative energies has almost come to a halt, because those investments were only profitable when oil was around, you know, $80, $90, $100 a barrel. That has to do with the way money works, which is probably the key component of my book, which is A Presidential Energy Policy, 25 points addressing the Siamese twins of energy and money. And money and energy truly are Siamese twins, and money is what is making it less probable that the human race can survive, because it is more profitable to accelerate or profit off of decline than to make investments. And the markets and the currencies are so threatened right now, they protect themselves first at the expense, likely, of the survival of the species.
Well, I guess what would happen then, because of the low prices, there has been very little investment in alternatives. So if the economy ever does pick up, it'll need oil, and that oil won't be there.
That's correct.
And so then prices could really take off again.
Well, and that will be the death knell for human industrialized civilization. I'm very clear in the book that the collapse of human industrial civilization is underway. It is irreversible. What is at stake now is the degree of the collapse, how far down it goes, what is destroyed, and what is left afterwards. And that's why this book is so important, because it offers a great many positive things, constructive things that can be done, just not just by President Obama, but by mayors, state and county officials, but also by individuals who will read the book, which gives, at a high school level of math, a very clear picture of what's going on, and opens the mind to many, many alternatives that people at every level, whether it's one person or the president, can take to start preparing and mitigating the crash right now.
Well, let's talk about some of those. You got 25 of them, and the way they're ranked, it's not in order of importance, I don't think, but where do you want to start with those?
Well, the very first point that I put in the book was to create a second SPRO, or Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPRO 2.
What does the O stand for, by the way?
Who knows? That just cropped up somewhere, but everybody calls it a SPRO.
Oh, okay.
The current SPRO that we have is, first of all, unrefined crude oil. It is stored in salt caverns in Texas and Louisiana, and it is only for release into the private market through oil companies, and not in any way reserved for use by the federal government or state and local governments. The first problem is it's not refined.
Mm-hmm.
The second problem is it's all in one geographic location, which, as we know, is threatened by climate change. We've had a few hurricanes down there. And we saw after Katrina that there were many state and local governments affected by the shutdown of the pipelines out of the Gulf who went to the state saying, you got to give us some gasoline. And the state said, no, we have it stored for us, but you don't have any. And, you know, it's fairly obvious that state and local governments, especially local governments, are the key first responders. The oil shortages are imminent. So what I propose is to create a second SPRO, roughly the same size as the first one, but of all refined products, and to set that aside for use by state and local governments, and to geographically disperse that throughout the country, with state and local governments paying all the costs after refining, and the federal government paying all the costs for pumping, transport, and refining, so that states and local entities can have reserves split up between gasoline, diesel, whatever, according to their needs, and accessible when the real fuel shortages start to become critical, because we have to keep ambulances, fire trucks.
Mm-hmm. Whoops. What happened?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now. There's a little momentarily silence there. What happened?
Hey, Pear, you know this stuff happens to me.
Well, anyway, okay, now you see we're saying that the way the SPRO is set up now, that if it's used, it gets released to the oil companies, and of course they would basically into the marketplace, and the marketplace rations oil by who's got the money to pay for it.
That's correct.
And what you're proposing is a different way of allocating oil by need, rather than that's really a revolutionary concept when you think about it. Whoops. Man, we're going in and out. This is amazing.
Yeah, I wonder.
Can we get him back again?
I'll try.
Okay. All right. Well, we were saying that he was talking about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The one they have now is unrefined oil. It's stored in salt caverns along the Gulf Coast. And what Mike is proposing is a second reserve, which would be for state and local governments. And what we're saying before we got cut off again was that this oil will be allocated by local governments according to need, like emergency services would be high on the list, health providers, and They would get the first crack at this oil because, okay, we are back again. Hello.
I'm here.
Okay. This is amazing. Anyway, we're so the oil would be allocated to local governments, and they would use it in by need. They would base it according to need, which is, to me, a very revolutionary thing to be saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an obvious thing to be saying based on common sense. Again, this book is a lot different from Rubicon, which was written, you know, as a legal case, 600 pages with 1,000 footnotes. It's never been challenged in the Harvard Business School library. But this book is written for people who with a high school education, and it is very easy to understand. And I was criticized a lot in years past for being Mr. Gloom and Doom and not offering a lot of positive solutions, and it was my position, and I lectured in Portland and all over Oregon many times, where I said, we have to get closer to the crisis event before we start looking at solutions. And now there are 25 clear points, and they address not only oil, but alternative energies, and there is no combination of alternative energies that will support the edifice built by fossil fuels. Nothing. There is no combination. Even in the future, it's just not possible. And at high school level math and common sense and logic, it is easy to see that. And I offer in the book some tests by which anyone who has a pet alternative energy they think is going to save mankind, where they can look at this test and quickly answer the questions for themselves, rather than us having to, you know, those in the movement having to answer the same questions over and over and over again. It's very clear that that's not possible. There are things that need to be encouraged and supported. President Obama's good on wind and solar. That won't do anything about transportation. It cannot possibly do anything about transportation. We waited too long to make the changes that we need. But there are some really, really good positive points. I think probably the most positive point, which both expands alternative energy use and addresses the way money works, is feed-in tariffs, which basically say that it's mandated by law that utilities will pay 3% above market for anybody who installs generating capacity, wind or solar, on their property and buy it back, which means you can't lose money on the investment. They've been used widely in Germany, and they have just done wonders for Germany to prepare, because now you have all over Germany, you know, thousands of homes and businesses that are self-generating their electricity, which takes them off the grid, makes them less vulnerable to disruption, selling energy back to the grid. The problem with that is it's really bad for stock value for large corporations and utilities that trade their stock on Wall Street and elsewhere.
I was under the impression that that has been used in some place. They talk about, you know, you have a solar thing on your roof or a windmill or something, and you can run your meter backwards when you're not using it.
Yeah, but there's been like a really unhealthy patchwork quilt of laws that in some cases prohibit people from generating more electricity than they use, and there's been no incentive. What a feed-in tariff would do would be to turbocharge the incentive for people to install wind and solar locally on their own property. And that's the best thing that we can possibly do to save lives, because electricity is the fundamental power for all industrial civilizations. And, of course, electricity is not a power source. It has to be generated from someplace.
Then you talk about rebuilding the rail system. Now, there is some talk about that, but I think there might be a little difference in what the Washington is talking about and what is needed.
Well, I mean, there's like sticking your toe in the water and diving in the pool. We have to dive in the pool on rebuilding U.S. rail infrastructure. It is incredibly efficient. I mean, we've all seen the commercials. I think it's like 300-plus miles per gallon per ton of freight by rail, which is just amazing. And that's going to be critical. And, again, we cannot wait too long to do this, because we are in the middle of a collapsing economy. Again, we're in a bear market rally, a sucker's rally right now that's going to go away. And where is the cash going to come from, the money? Here we come back to energy and money again, to rebuild the rail system in 2-3 years when virtually everything has shut down.
Well, what they're talking about, at least some people, is high-speed lines, you know, between the big cities like from Boston down to Washington and from Vancouver, BC down to, San Francisco or LA or whatever. And what we need more than that is rebuilding the rail system we have so it can carry freight trains and passengers.
And carry food, because our food system is horribly threatened. And look, we all have to recognize now that globally and nationally, we're having huge freshwater crises. Our food infrastructure is falling apart, again, because of the way money works, where crops are having to be destroyed because farmers can't transport it, they can't pay off the loans, and the crops are rotting. That all has to do with the way money works, not the actual mechanics of growing food and getting it into people's mouths, which is critical. Again, and here, Oregon especially, and the Portland area, because there's been a lot of work by peak oil activists up there and sustainability advocates to grow local food. You have a good climate for that, but it's still way far behind where it needs to be to sustain life.
Well, I can sort of envision them bringing in food shipments on the light rail system we have and having a huge farmer's market down at Pioneer Square or something. But what about money? It seems to me we have a system where you have fiat money, but too bad we can't have fiat energy.
Well, that is, in essence, Per, the fundamental point of the whole book. Once people understand that, everything else kind of falls, if you will, into place. Money by itself is only a symbol. Money, you can't eat a dollar bill. You can't stuff a $20 bill in your gas tank to run.
Mm-hmm.
Money represents the ability to do work. Energy is the ability to do work. Whether sometimes money represented slave labor, you had slaves to do the work. Now we have energy slaves. But the laws of thermodynamics are very clear. Energy cannot be created or destroyed, and it only converts in one direction from usable to unusable, and energy is always lost in every transaction. So for all the trillions that have been printed since the economic collapse began, they all represent, if you will, a future obligation to spend energy that cannot and will never be there. Period. There's no way around that. Mankind's desire to supersede the physical laws of nature is colliding with the nature itself, if you will, the planet itself, which is finite and unyielding. And we're drinking a lot of Kool-Aid because these trillions of dollars are going to come back. There will inevitably be hyperinflation as the world dumps the dollar. I've been predicting that for years. And of all people, you have to know how accurate all of my predictions have been since about 2001, 2002, when we first met. And the reason why these predictions are accurate, not just mine, but of all the peak oil sustainability movement, is because we have a map that tells us how the world works. And our map must be accurate if we are calling and have been calling all of these events so precisely for so many years.
Well, as far as energy input goes, the only real input is just the energy we get from the sun.
Basically, all energy on the planet is solar energy. Mm-hmm. If you think that it was sunlight which fed the algae and plankton which died, became oil, or which became coal, or which became natural gas, or whatever the case may be. It's also very clear in the book, I should add, that all are destructive and suicidal. That doesn't mean you can't recycle, some used vegetable oil from the Burger King. That won't sustain anything. That's a mitigating thing. But ethanol and all those biofuels, anything that uses plant waste, neglects the fact that you have to return organic matter to the soil to enable the soil to grow anything.
So eventually we will have to live on our energy income, which is what we get from the sun every year.
Well, we will, in one way or another, revert to some kind of stasis or balance. Now, the problem is there are 5 billion people alive on the planet today that were not alive before the age of oil, and there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food. It is axiomatic that there will have to be a die-off. Now, how big it's going to be, how vicious it's going to be, how it's going to happen is one of the things that I call for a species-wide dialogue, a global dialogue about in this book, because it's very clear that what's happening now is neither fair nor rational. And it kind of appears to me, and has for a while, that, you know, some people may have a plan on how to kill several billion people, and I would like to be included in that discussion.
Well, a die-off sort of implies that there are people living today who will not be living, so in the future. But it could also mean that people who, you know, birth control would mean that there are people not being born. And so you have an attrition, the normal way of life and death goes on, and you just don't add more and more people to this mix.
Well, human population is still growing. We're mm-hmm. knocking on 7 billion right now, and human population is still growth. All things like birth control do is talk about how to slow the rate of growth. They don't do anything about reversing it. It's going to reverse one way or another, whether we choose to do something about it proactively or to address it or not. That can't be changed. And the book is so important because it really puts on the table the fundamental issues. There are specific things that President Obama can do. I have a political science background. I've been around government many times. I've been around the halls of Congress many times. I know members of Congress who are reading the book right now. And we go on sale tomorrow. By the way, I should mention that all I want to find out about the book, I now have only one place to go to get to all the other websites, the old FTW site, the blog, but the new site is RubiconWorks.com, and that's a portal to all of the websites, and the book will be on sale there tomorrow, May 1st, and it should go on sale worldwide. We have great support from Amazon, a great publisher in New World Digital. We've got a new publishing paradigm. We will only print books that are going to be sold rather than using up resources, shipping trees and printing stuff around. And we expect to have a very good impact. And it's very important that for those who are active and concerned about peak oil and sustainability, that they buy as many copies of this book as possible, because we have to break the New York Times list to get the mainstream media attention that's going to be necessary to save lives. This is our last shot. Those who have been active in the movement for a long time, who have been waiting for somebody to listen to all the great messages, the Matt Simmonses, the Richard Heinbergs, the Julian Darleys, Mark Rabinowitz in Eugene, all the great people who have been out here, we've got our track shoes on, and now we have to make people listen, and this is the chance to do it.
So how would they do this? Now, place an order online, and then what happens? How does that work?
Well, as of tomorrow, when the sale goes hot, every button on the From the Wilderness site, the Rubicon Works site, the blog, every place else will go to Amazon.com. Amazon has been terrific in getting this book up and ready to go. Then you buy the book from Amazon, but now the way this one starts is, even if you're a Barnes & Noble and you want the book, you have to buy the book wholesale from Amazon. That way, only the number of books that are actually going to be read and sold are printed. That saves resources and energy.
So can a bookstore order a bunch of them or take
Absolutely.
Orders?
Absolutely. Now, I haven't learned yet what kind of discount pricing is available for wholesalers. I'm sure that that's going to be available. Amazon is also the exclusive distributor for Kindle and all electronic forms of the book. Kindle is very hot right now. But the books will be printed. In other words, if you were to order the book in a paperback form, it will come to you from Amazon exactly the way a normal book does, looking exactly like a normal book. Won't be able to tell the difference. It's the same thing.
Hmm. Well, that's a very interesting concept. Well, we have a few minutes left. What do you want to say? Had to wrap this up. I mean, what's you had a message about the flu epidemic.
Well, yeah, and we have to be brief because we don't have a lot mm-hmm. of time here. But, one of the things that is so clear to me is that when you distill everything down, the ultimate problem is the way money works is killing the human race, and there are too many of us. And it occurred to me yesterday why everybody's so concerned about the swine flu. Now, I have information about that on the blog that's very interesting, connections with the Spanish flu and many other things. But with 7 billion people on the planet, we're like popcorn. There are more of us bumping into more of us faster than ever in history, thanks to oil-powered transportation. We're moving around faster, and that's why the contagion is so much more threatening, because it can spread so fast it can't be controlled. And, you know, it does. It's just basic common sense. And so we don't know whether this is going to be, you know, a great die-off plague or not. I think certainly one of those is coming sooner or later. But there's certainly good reason to be justified, and I think the WHO made a very good call yesterday.
Well, there's been talk now that this plague started with a giant pig processing place in Mexico, which is actually owned by Smithfield.
Yeah, but you have to be careful with that. Mm-hmm. I've seen like 4 or 5 reports saying it didn't originate there, and quite frankly, who knows where it originated. And sometimes... Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we have more beeps. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, it's like understanding is the booby prize. Let's figure out where it came from later. Let's address the problem mm-hmm. right now. But again, there are energy connections to this as well.
Okay, our time is up. We've been talking to Mike Rupert, who is the author of a Presidential Energy Policy, which is coming out tomorrow. And you can access that. Go to RubiconWorks.com. Is that what it is?
That's what it is, Perry.
Okay, RubiconWorks. Okay, thanks a lot, Mike, and hope to talk to you again soon.
And a big warm hello to all my friends in Portland. I miss you guys a lot, and maybe we'll see you soon.
Hey, I hope so. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey now, this is David Lemieux. Don't forget that this Saturday, May 2nd, 2009, from noon to 8 p.m. right here on KBOO 90.7 FM is the Grateful Dead Marathon, where we'll have loads of great stuff and probably some cool things straight out of the vault. So don't forget to tune in May 2nd, noon to 8 p.m. right here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-sponsored community radio coming up next. Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, producer Nora Barros-Friedman presents a special interview on Israel and apartheid in occupied Palestine. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach speaks with acclaimed writer T.C. Boyle about his latest book, The Women, a novel about the wives and lovers of Frank Lloyd Wright. All that coming up this morning on KBOO. Words and Pictures follows that. Stay tuned. Before we go on, I'd just like to say this. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. And now stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Portland's airwaves make for a tangled web of special interests.
The Seattle man who thought Eastern Oregon looked enough like Afghanistan to make a good Taliban training camp wishes he hadn't expressed that thought.
And Chrysler is dodging creditors all the way to bankruptcy court.
Portland area weather, partly cloudy, patchy morning fog in the north, slight chance of showers and highs in the 60s. Tonight, increasing clouds, especially in the south, lows in the 40s. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy and maybe some rain.
And first, we go to regional news from around Cascadia. The world has squandered its water resources, as it has so many others. In the future, people are going to have to become better stewards of potable water supplies and ingenious collectors of previously owned water. Here in Oregon, gray water legislation is wending its way through the legal process. With me this morning to talk about gray water legislation is Brenna Bell of Tryon Life Community Farm. Brenna is not on the line at this moment, but we will try to reach her a bit later in the broadcast, so be sure to stay tuned for that.
A conference on biomass at the Portland Expo Center this week drew more than 1,000 attendees from 25 countries. The biomass industry includes ethanol, biodiesel, and other fuels that use renewable materials to decrease the use of petroleum. The industry has come under fire for offering products such as ethanol, which comes with higher costs, less fuel economy, and more demand on crops.
And at this point, we won't say anything about LNG, but it should be in the back of everyone's mind when they hear news stories of that sort. What creates jobs, saves energy, and cuts greenhouse gas emissions? The City of Portland and Multnomah County's new plan to stop providing low-cost financing to homeowners this summer for energy efficiency and weatherization improvements. The goal of the so-called Clean Energy Fund is to overcome the biggest barriers to large-scale energy efficiency efforts, steep upfront costs and uncertain payback, and a general lack of information about how best to proceed.
Governor Kulongoski has threatened to use his veto if lawmakers write specific highway projects, earmarks, into a transportation funding bill aimed at creating construction jobs and relieving traffic congestion. Democratic leaders say the veto threat was surprising given the governor's good relationship with them and his desire for a major jobs creation bill this session. But isn't that what earmarks are for?
Exactly. That's what it's all about. It's the earmarks, stupid. An unlikely quartet of legislators has latched on to a modern-day way to open up the state's books by searchable database. The aim of House Bill 2500 is to create a one-stop website that shows how much Oregon state agencies spend and on what? Earmarks. Republicans Kim Thatcher of Kaiser and Gene Wisnant of Sun River have testified shoulder to shoulder with Democrats Jefferson Smith of Portland and Arnie Roblin of Coos Bay.
Portland Police Chief Rosie Sizer got the go-ahead yesterday to move forward with her plan to consolidate precincts from 5 to 3. The idea is to make it cheaper to keep Portlanders in line. It's complicated, but here are some highlights. All officers in the Southeast and North precincts, which will close patrol operations, have their new assignments and shifts. The Bureau will maintain Central, Northeast, and East precincts in a restructuring that's estimated to save $3.6 million and help the department reach a 2.5% budget cut for next fiscal year.
As newspapers loudly proclaim their own demise, media markets consolidate into clear channels, and the internet floats above the airwaves. Radio is taking a beating. In Portland, the question is, how independent is independent when it comes to the nexus between content and ownership? My guest today, Scott Forrester, has been looking at the radio landscape lately. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Chris.
So there have been issues with ownership and content at KMHD, KZME, and NPR. What's going on in that market?
Well, out here in East County, in Gresham, a 25-year-old station, KMHD, which is a jazz station currently, hasn't always been jazz, is owned by the Mount Hood Community College. And those college board members, some of them, three of them, are up for election in this May's special election. And, well, it's supposed to be held, the license, for the citizens. And what they're talking about is a proposal that went to the Mount Hood Community College Board in the last 30 days, where Oregon Public Broadcasting would, in essence, be signed over to manage the station in all of its entirety, and that the college would merely maintain the license. Some people are concerned that the next step would then to be in the future to transfer the license ownership permanently over to Oregon Public Broadcasting, increasing their kingdom of stations.
So how does this affect content?
Well, in terms of content, there's a lot of changes, as you know, in media, including radio. And instead of having a discussion, there was some critics there of the move. They have never had a discussion with the very community, the voters, and the taxpayers that actually own the FCC license about maybe changing the content. For instance, there is not a single minute of local news. Now, there are announcements maybe for occasional issues around the community, but no news at all. There's a little BBC piped in, and that's it. So wouldn't it be nice for the fourth largest city, Gresham in Oregon, and also East County, which in population rivals close to Portland if you take all the folks left over in Multnomah County, we'd love to have some local news out here. And that's not going to happen if OPB gets the management, because they made a promise. They said that we will keep it jazz and jazz only. So that way, also, OPB will not get competition. So there'll be no other news on Left the Dial that you can tune to, that if OPB is not offering news or KBOO is offering news, to get perhaps even a third choice.
Or an East County perspective, perhaps a more rural perspective.
Which is missing.
What other rural markets? Anything else that you care to add?
Well, two other things. Folks that don't know in the radio world out there is that KBPS out of Benson High School had been, the license I think was almost a half century old. The FCC license, there's an AM one as well, was actually sold to a nonprofit to maintain classical. Again, there was no discussion by then the Portland Public School Board that owned the license about having the community have a say in having KBPS and the students there to be able to perhaps do news for students and maybe have also a different perspective. That was a bellwether for what's happening here potentially, which is not done yet at KMHD. And then lastly, KZME is a new station that may be opening up in the next year out at Metro East Community Media, the old cable access television. And the former station manager of KBOO, Denise Gavalchek, is running the show out there on this new radio station, and so far it appears to be only local music and little, if any, news and public affairs. But
we'll see. Almost out of time, Scott. Is there anything else that you'd like to add very briefly?
Well, yes. KBOO has applied for a license in Pendleton, Oregon, last year, and this year it may be awarded a new license, which I believe would be the first new license in about 20 years or so since we got the Corvallis translator license.
Thank you so much for that. My guest
Thank
has been
much.
Scott Forrester. Thank you so much. And now I do believe that we have Brenna Bell on the line. We'll try and bring you that story on gray water legislation at another time.
With Oregon's unemployment rate topping 12%, the State House of Representatives approved a bill to expand the WorkShare program. The program encourages companies to retain rather than fire employees during a downturn. They can reduce workers' hours by as much as 40%, and the reduction in pay is offset by the workers' unemployment benefits. House Bill 3140 expands WorkShare benefits from 26 weeks to a full year.
They've been busy down in Salem, haven't they? Mm. In these strange days, the big three automakers' CEOs have taken to driving to D.C. in hybrid SUVs to ask for money. But the improbable fallout appeared yesterday as Cessna Aircraft Company announced that it would close its Bend plant. Sales have plummeted because of the recession and private corporate aviation's public disgrace.
The Army Corps of Engineers plans to spend almost $200 million in economic stimulus money for repairs and construction in Oregon and Washington. The 266 projects include restoration of three tribal fishing grounds, repairing dams in the Columbia River system, and improving lakes and coastal harbors.
And Spokane-based utility Avista Corporation supplies natural gas to the Rogue Valley. Yesterday, the company reported net income of $31 million for the first quarter of 2009. That's down from the first quarter of last year. The company plans to request regulators to lower prices for Washington and Idaho customers. Here's an idea. Sell the stuff to California. They're desperate for it.
A former Seattle man testified at a terrorism trial that he tried to create a militant jihad training camp in Oregon, but he no longer supports terrorist causes. James Ujamaa told a jury in federal court in Manhattan that he envisioned the camp in 1999 as a military-style training ground for Muslims who would fight in Afghanistan. Ujamaa was called by prosecutors as a witness in the trial of Usama Qasir. Qasir is accused of helping al-Qaeda by trying to set up a weapons training post in the small eastern Oregon town of Bly.
And we thought rural Oregon was boring. As the Republican Party becomes increasingly bereft of new ideas, the hardcore right-wing led by the likes of Rush Limbaugh, are whipping their minions into a frenzy. Now that Arlen Specter has come over from the dark side, Democrats are just one seat short of a filibuster-proof majority. KBOO's Spencer Raymond is with us this morning to talk about what this means. Good morning, Spencer.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. I think what we've seen here when Specter jumped to the Democrats is kind of a result of what's been happening to the Republican Party really since John McCain's campaign really got moving last summer. The Republican Party is becoming more and more conservative-based, making moderates like Arlen Specter uncomfortable. And that was one of the justifications Specter gave for wanting to become a Democrat, is that he didn't feel comfortable as a Republican anymore because he couldn't identify with what he said was a conservative base that was not in line with his own feelings and much of his constituents in the state of Pennsylvania. And if going back to John McCain, a lot of people years ago were worried about a possible John McCain presidential contender against a Democrat because he was a moderate. But as soon as he became the Republican nominee, it seems like he changed. With the Sarah Palin pick, he was all of a sudden far to the right, a conservative candidate. Chris, what we're seeing is a morphing of the Republican Party, and they're losing members. They're trying to kick out more of their moderate people. They don't want moderate Republicans. They're asking them to become Democrats if they don't want to be staunch conservatives. And you have to ask the question, what is going to happen to this Republican Party? How can a Republican candidate get elected in a state other than the Deep South?
I'll tell you how. Another national emergency, and that's what's got me worried. It seems that certain interests are able to pull these events out of a hat when they're cornered and in a bad spot, and that has me greatly, greatly concerned. Apparently, the threat of domestic terror from the lunatic fringe white supremacist cadres has been studied recently, and people are very. There are people out there that who are very angry about President Obama and his policies, and the very fact that he is President Obama.
And so another thing, Chris. Another thing that the Republicans are worried about is how can they regain a majority in either the House or the Senate. They're facing two elections in a row of defeat in both chambers, and the party really has to do some thinking of how they can develop an identity that people can relate to in order to get votes. And a lot of people are thinking that the further and further right they go, the more people they actually lose. And there's no one really in the party yet who has come up with a good idea to broaden its appeal and to get more Republicans registered so they can get back to more of a respectable position in Congress.
Thank you so much for that. That is, of course, KBO's reporter Spencer Raymond joining us, as he does every weekday morning, with D.C. Dirt. Thank you, Spencer. And now, very briefly.
In Salem, utility workers suspect an osprey made a mess of its breakfast by dropping a fish on a power line, turning out the lights for folks trying to find their way to start the day.